This is the time set for the oral argument of the Southern Nevada panel of the Supreme Court, Justice Ron Perigary, Justice Lydia Stiglitz, and I'm Justice Michael Charity, presiding justice. Our first case today is case number 70542. Richard Devante, I guess it's Devante Richard versus State, Mr. Percival and Mr. Giolini. Correct?
Yes,
Mr. Percival? For the appellant. You have 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve some time for rebuttal?
I would like to reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, Supreme Court counsel, this morning we're here to address some evidentiary issues that arose in the trial of my client, Devante Richard, nearly 3 years ago. At the trial in this matter, the state put on evidence from Detective Theodore Wyrock concerning an identification and a description of the alleged perpetrator, who was at that time alleged to be my client, Devante Richard, in the trial. That those letters, both those, the description and the alleged identification out of court, were urged upon the court as prior inconsistent statements made by the alleged victim in the case, Trayvon Kennard, who testified at the trial. Notably, however, Mr. Kennard was never asked to testify about whether he had previously described Devante Richard to the detectives, and he was never asked at trial whether he had made an identification of Devante Richard to the detectives at any time prior to the court. Further, he was not asked specifically if he could identify the defendant in the courtroom at the time of trial. There was a question, if I were to ask you if you could identify the perpetrator today, what would your answer be? He said no. He was never asked specifically to look around the courtroom and identify or not identify the defendant as the perpetrator who assaulted him at the Terrible Hurts car wash back in 2015. Because Mr. Kennard, well, there were three questions asked specifically with respect to identification of the defendant as the perpetrator. One was whether he could or had seen the man's face, to which Mr. Kennard testified, no, I couldn't see his face because it was covered by a hood that he was wearing on his hooded sweatshirt, and I couldn't see it. He was asked another identifying question, what color the hooded sweatshirt that the assailant was wearing was, and Mr. Kennard testified that he couldn't remember what color the hooded sweatshirt was. However, later in his testimony, when confronted with his voluntary statement, a transcript of his voluntary statement, he said, oh, I did say that it was reddish in color, and I'm not contesting the contents of my prior voluntary statement. And finally, I already went over it. He asked if, when asked if he saw, if he was able to identify the person in the courtroom that day, he said no. He was not asked, have you ever previously identified Mr. Richard as the assailant that tried to take your gold chain on the date of this incident. He was also never asked, have you given a description to the detectives other than the fact that he was wearing a hoodie on prior occasions? Neither of those things were asked, and he did not testify to those things.
Mr. Percival?
Yes.
If I may, even if the court were to credit the argument, let's just say for purposes of argument, there were some errors in the admission of that testimony.
Yes.
What effect did that have on the trial where Richard's own voluntary statement says that he grabbed the chain? If we're looking at the whole picture now, and you say, okay, there's error there, how do you get this court to the next step?
Well, Judge, it's difficult for me to put myself in the minds of the 12 jurors that made this decision. But in my mind, there is little in the way of evidence that is more damning than the statement of an eyewitness that identifies the defendant as the perpetrator. I have argued and would continue to argue that although he admitted that he had been Mirandized, I can't take issue with that. I mean, the record speaks for itself. But when one actually reads the contents of his statement that was given to Detective Weirach and Detective Spiotto, you know, on subsequent occasions, particularly the first one, it's clear that he was intoxicated, and I don't recall if the actual CD recording was made a part of the record on appeal. But when one listens to that, particularly the first statement, he is very groggy, lethargic, babbling, and quite frankly, many of his responses to the questioning of the detective were actually non-responsive to the question. He was the detective would ask about who was the guy you were with, and he says, I don't know, I was just walking with him, it was a cell phone. Well, he's actually talking about two different people. But his ability to elucidate and enunciate at the time of his first interview at the hospital, mere hours after he had been shot and while he was under medication, would, in my mind, draw into serious question whether he was able to voluntarily and intelligently make a decision as to whether or not he would talk to the detective about this incident. Obviously, had he had the benefit of counsel probably would have, or I certainly would have, told him to keep his mouth shut, but that wasn't the case. I can't tell you how the jury would have weighed that against the other issues, but really it appears to me that Detective Weirach and Detective Spiotto's testimony was, I mean, it may have been frosting on a cake that didn't need to be frosted. But the frosting was certainly prejudicial to my client's interests. And further, I mean, the rule, as I understand it and I read it, requires that would allow some of this testimony in if the declarant had been present and subject to cross-examination on the subject matter that the detective later supplemented. But when he's not asked about, did you ever give a description of the defendant, he never denies it, he's never asked to re-give the description, and then the detective is able to fill in the blanks, well, this is what he told me, A, B, C, D, and E.
Well, we try not to tell the district attorney how to try a case, and certainly every trial attorney has their own way of bringing out prior inconsistent statements. What was wrong about the way that the district attorney brought this out? You have to help me with this.
Judge, here's the thing. If we're going to bring this out as an inconsistent statement, it has to be inconsistent with his in-court testimony. He was never asked about whether he gave a description of the perpetrator, this being Mr. Kennard. Mr. Kennard was never asked if he was asked to give a description on a prior occasion. He never testified that he didn't give a description, and he never testified to a description that was different than the one that Detective Weirach came out. So,
what if the jury was surprised? Let's say they thought that this fellow was going to definitely ID the defendant, which they expect, and all of a sudden he doesn't, and he says, "I can't make an identification." Well, what's wrong with later bringing on a police officer to say that he made an identification before? Isn't that the basic Wigmore evidence prior inconsistent statement?
Well, I would say no, Judge, because they weren't surprised that he wasn't going to identify him. He had not identified him at the grand jury proceeding. He had not identified him in other statements. The proper way, in my mind, and I don't pretend to be Wigmore, but the proper way to get this on is to bring the testimony out or get him to refuse to give the testimony before bringing on a detective to make a prior inconsistent statement at a presentation.
Was this presented to the district court judge as you were presenting it to us?
I attempted to present it in this fashion to the district court judge.
Let me ask you, my understanding was there was no objection. Constitute plain error, and why isn't it harmless, considering Blake's testimony and the fact that it probably is duplicative?
Well, it's true that there was no objection to his testimony about the reddish color of the hoodie. My recollection is that I did not object to that because Mr. Kennard had already conceded, "Oh yes, I did say that." But unless I missed something, I think I did object to further testimony about his physical description, and why is it not? How is it plain error? Well, it certainly takes away his. He was never afforded an opportunity to cross-examine the declarant, the out-of-court declarant, concerning those prior statements because they weren't brought out.
You only have about 2 minutes.
And I think I'd like to pass to the state and reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
You have about 2.5 minutes left. For the district attorney's office.
Good morning, Justice. My name is John Giordani. I was one of the two trial attorneys on Nevada v. Monte Richard. Briefly, I'd like to first address the alleged hearsay statements. The state's position at trial and the state's position now is that these were prior inconsistent statements. Kirsten Kennard testified on direct examination. He was reluctant to testify. He was brought in against his will. He didn't recall the statements given in the hospital. He didn't recall the color of the hood of the man that attempted to rob him. On cross-examination, he specifically stated, and I quote, "did not remember being visited by a detective in the hospital, and did not remember giving a statement to police." That's on cross-examination from Mr. Percival on this question. That, as you know, pursuant to Crowley and the progeny case that comes since, is tantamount to a denial of any statement made in the hospital. And our position at the time and again now is that any statement made in the hospital would include the identification he made to Detective Weirach. We did not bring that up directly or say, "Did you identify the person who attempted to rob you in the hospital?" Because we didn't need to at that time. And to the Justice Stiglitz's question earlier, the reason we didn't need to do that at the time was because the identity of the perpetrator did not matter. He identified himself. And he didn't just identify himself on one occasion, he did it on 3 separate occasions. One thing I noticed from the briefs is that the third interview of the defendant was not brought up at all. You have to remember that this was two separate incidents that we charged and were trying. There was a robbery that occurred at an ATM machine about 2 weeks prior to the shootout that occurred at the car wash. In that robbery, there was a firearm taken from Luis Ruiz, the victim in that case, and then subsequently that firearm was in Devontae Richards' pocket and brought out and dropped after the shooting at the car wash. So Detective Miller, who's not referenced at all in the briefs, he went to interview Devontae Richard 2 weeks after the two interviews that are referenced throughout. And in that case, he describes his own red hood and he minimizes his conduct in the initial instance. As you know, then he gives two separate confessions on the day he was shot, one of which is a minute and a half and the other of which is approximately 5 minutes. With that, I'll move on to the confrontation issue since it was brought up briefly. In this particular case, the victim was on the stand subject to cross-examination. Crawford, every case that's come down since, indicates that it's an opportunity to cross-examine that matters. Now, I can understand why Mr. Percival would not want to bring up this identification if the state hadn't brought it up first, because it doesn't help his client in any way. But he certainly had the opportunity to cross-examine the victim throughout his testimony. If you'd like to hear from me on the voluntariness of the statements, I will address that, although Mr. Percival did not. Does the court have any questions with regard to the voluntariness of the two statements?
I don't.
Does it look like that?
Thank you. I'll just add and wrap it up. The evidence in this case was overwhelming, so if for any reason this court believes that the district court erred in any way, any error would be harmless. In addition to the confessions that I previously discussed, there were several eyewitnesses at this busy car wash on a Sunday afternoon. There was videotape of the aftermath of the shooting. There was obviously forensic evidence. There was a trail of blood leading to the defendant, who admittedly was shot during this altercation and then is subsequently identified in the hospital.
Just curious, I just have one question. Was there any motion for severance or anything as to trying the cases separately?
I don't recall a severance of the counts, a motion for severance of the counts. However, I'd stepped onto this case approximately 2 weeks prior to trial, so if it was litigated prior to me coming to trial, I just don't recall.
I was just curious about that. We're seeing a lot of cases now where, I guess because Petruccelli is so liberal in this state, that it doesn't matter whether you join it or not, the evidence is going to come in either as a Petruccelli or it's going to come in as a substantive count.
Understood.
But I don't know. In the old days when I was a defense attorney, we fought like hell to make sure that you only tried one case at a time.
Understood. The gun was used, yeah, involved in both cases here.
Just for your own information, there was a time when the federal government insisted that if there was a gun used, there was no deals. And this was in the early 70s. And I was assistant public defender, and one guy had five robberies, and we had to try three robberies in a row before finally Chief Judge Christensen, may rest in peace, said, no more, that's it. Three trials are enough, we're not going to do five trials. So that's for your information.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Make sure you get your money's worth.
Sure. All right.
Separate apart from the harmless error analysis, if we even get there, would you agree it would have been probably prudent to confront the witness with the particular statement, especially as it related to the in the hospital identification?
Prudent in hindsight, assuming we knew we'd be here today, potentially. At the time, I don't think that anything was wrong with the way the questions were asked on direct, and especially in redirect, because during cross-examination, the witness said, I don't recall the statements made in the hospital. I don't recall talking to a detective. So there was absolutely no reason to come back and then say, well, do you recall telling him this? Do you recall identifying the defendant? Mm-hmm. So at the time, I don't believe it would have been more prudent to do that. In fact, we probably decided otherwise.
And at trial, were these admitted as a prior identification or as prior inconsistent statements?
Prior inconsistent statements. Based upon the denials pursuant to Crawley, that's tantamount, or I'm sorry, the lack of recollection, which would be tantamount to a denial. Thank you.
Mr. Percival, you have 2.5 minutes.
I'll try and be brief then. Judge, it is true that Mr. Kennard did, on my cross-examination, deny recollection of giving the statements to the detectives at the hospital. However, when I confronted him with the transcript of the statement. So would this refresh your recollection about having made these comments? He said, he says, yes, it does refresh. And that
so
is,
clock,
that's in the appendix at, oh yeah, I got a few extra seconds. That's in the appendix at page 315, lines 15 through 17, where he says, yes, I do, that refreshes my recollection about having made these statements at UMC. It's, all I can do is reiterate, he was never asked about the statements in court that he had made previously. And he was never asked to give his present description of the person that assaulted him at trial. Therefore, there was no statement to be inconsistent with. Prior inconsistent statement requires that he be examined on the subject matter and give a statement that is either contradictory to or inconsistent with what he has said previously. He didn't say anything inconsistent with or contradictory to what he said in the hospital. He was never asked about it, and Mr. Giordani is correct. There are reasons I didn't want to go into that, certainly. But if they're going to supplement the what he had said with the detective's recounting of the description and an identification that, by the way, wasn't on tape, wasn't on a transcript, wasn't recorded in any other fashion than the detective's testimony, they should have asked him previous, at trial, didn't you identify him in the hospital, or something of that nature? And when he denies it, then the detective is free to say, oh, that's, now I have a prior inconsistent statement. But until we reach that threshold, there hasn't been a foundation laid that there is an inconsistent statement.
Mr. Purcell, I don't know that he ever admitted that his recollection was refreshed. I have the page that you're talking about. The question is, does looking at that document refresh your recollection about giving a statement at UMC Hospital? Yeah.
Well,
so what's the answer? Is this does he remember giving a statement now? He refreshed his recollection. I mean, it's still the next question.
I suppose maybe I should have taken I should have taken one more step and said, and do you recall making it now? But I certainly didn't want to go into the substantive contents of the statement. So, not at that point anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Crispin.
Thank you.
The court thanks both counsel for their arguments this evening.